Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we all have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of Judges with the usurper Abimelech. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. We have been studying the book of Judges, and we are on chapter 9. We just completed our consideration of the career of Gideon, who was the fifth judge. We had seen that the people of Israel had asked him to become a king, but he readily refused the throne, acknowledging that the Lord was the true king. And that was certainly true over Israel at the time. However, we saw that Gideon made an ephod, a priestly garment, for his family, which was contrary to God's commands, because only the tribe of Levi and the family of Aaron could be the priests. Yet his judgeship overall was good. But when he died, the people of Israel, we saw, failed to acknowledge all the good he had done for them. And we will see how low their ingratitude went today. In Judges chapter 9 and verse 1, we read, "Then Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem, to his mother's brothers, and spoke with them, and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying." So here we see once more Abimelech. And we first met Abimelech back in chapter 8, verses 30 and 31, when we read that Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, and remember, a concubine was more or less a slave wife or an employee wife. She was still just a slave or an employee, but the man got to use her as a wife. And yet she didn't have any of the privileges of a wife. She remained a slave. It was not a good thing, but it was part of their culture at the time, unfortunately. Thankfully, we don't have that anymore. But his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. And we talked about the fact that Abimelech means "my father is king." Well, that's exactly what Gideon had refused to do. He had refused to become a king. And yet we can see in this the ambition of his mother. Well, the ambition of his mother, it seems, rubs off on Abimelech, because he comes up with a scheme. And his scheme is he goes to Shechem. Now remember, Shechem was not where Gideon was from. He was from Ophrah. But this concubine of his was from Shechem. So he goes to his mother's brothers. These would be his uncles, of course. And he speaks with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father. So he speaks with their household. So he's figuring, these are my relatives, I can get them on my side. So what does he propose to them? Verse 2, "Please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. Which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and bone." So Abimelech says to his family, "Speak to the men of Shechem and tell them this." So these deceitful and manipulative words. What are they to say? "Which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal reign over you, or that one reign over you?" Now there's no doubt about it, this was a false choice. No one was suggesting that there would be 70 kings over Israel, that the 70 sons of Jerubbaal would reign, or that of Gideon would reign. Remember, Jerubbaal was another name for Gideon that they had given to him when he had torn down Baal's altar. It means, let Baal deal with him, which of course Baal never did, because he was a false god. So he says, "Do you want all 70 of his sons to reign over you, or just one?" And that was a false choice, and nobody would ever have promoted 70 kings. But this is something that I think politicians often do, is that when they're proposing something, they set up a false choice. Like, if you don't go with their proposal, you must be supporting this other ridiculous thing. When the fact is that you could easily be against their proposal and yet not support the ridiculous thing that they suggest is the alternative. So setting up a false alternative is a good way to manipulate people. Now notice what he also points out to them. "I am your own flesh and bone." So here he's suggesting nepotistic benefits. "Since you're my home city, since I'm descended from one of your leading families." Well, just imagine, if I become king, think of the benefits for Shechem. Think of the benefits for you. I can enrich you. I can give you kickbacks and so forth if I'm the king. So this is meant to appeal to their greed. Verse 3, and his mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the ears of all the men of Shechem. And their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. So his uncles go along with what he suggested. And they propose this to all the men of Shechem. And the men of Shechem listen, because they say, well, he is related to us. So they like the idea of kickbacks from the king. Verse 4, so they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-Berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. So the men of Shechem, they give him funds for his scheme. 70 of silver. Probably does mean a shekel, a considerable sum. Now notice they give him this silver from the temple of Baal-Berith. Well, what's this? What is this temple and where is it? Well, apparently it's the temple where the people of Shechem are worshiping. So notice they're not worshiping Jehovah, the true king of Israel, and the true God of Israel. They're worshiping Baal-Berith, this false god of the nations around them. But they take money out of Baal-Berith's temple and they give it to Abimelech. Well, he uses it to hire worthless and reckless men. Worthless there means vain or empty. So these would be men who were, we might say, not the heirs. Remember back then, as I've told you many times, they had a patriarchal system. Everybody had a family business. Nobody really went and worked at another business outside the home. You were part of a household, even if you were, say, the family of the butlers. You were inside a household as the family of the butlers, and you are part of the household. You didn't work outside the household, generally. Now, it was very important that the father, the patriarch, he was the CEO. And his son, usually his eldest son, would be the one who would inherit. Maybe he would train his second eldest some in case the eldest got killed or something. But if you went down to the youngest of, say, 7 or 8, he would figure he's never going to be in charge of the family. So he has no real future there. So he could be one of these empty people. He has no inheritance, really no hope of inheriting in his father's house. So he doesn't know what he wants to do with himself. He doesn't have a goal in life. And so he's ready to be a hired thug if somebody comes and pays him enough. Now, of course, this would be according to his character too, not just his social standing, because not everybody who was youngest would be this kind of person. But he finds such people, empty people, and reckless, willing to do anything. And he hires them to be his hired thugs. And they follow him. Verse 5, then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left because he hid himself. So he went to his father's house at Ophrah. Remember, that is in Manasseh, where his father's family lived, place of the Abiezrites. And he takes these men that he hired, his hired thugs, his hired killers, as it turns out, because with them he captures and murders all his brothers. Of course, these would be his half-brothers. We could say we can't say that they're the legitimate sons, because he's legitimate. Just because you were the son of a slave wife doesn't mean you're illegitimate. But they are the non-slave sons, we might say. And he kills them all, his half-brothers. It says all on one stone. Now, they probably use this stone as a backstop for beheading. I mean, you put them down on the stone, then you take your sword and whack, off goes the head. You have a nice backstop for the sword. You know, as opposed to something soft, or the sword would dig into it or something. Use the stone as a backstop for beheading. So he kills them all on the same stone, one at a time. But he misses one. He misses Jotham, the youngest. Jotham means Jehovah is upright. Notice even his name is much better than Abimelech, my father is king. An untrue, but ambitious name. Jehovah is upright. He escapes because he hides himself. And I don't know what the significance is of him being the youngest. Maybe he just was able to run the fastest, or maybe he was out playing when this happened. I don't know for sure how young he was, of course. But he hides himself, and so he doesn't die. Verse 6, And all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. So the city of Shechem and all the house of the mound, that's what Beth Millo means. Beth means house, Millo means a mound. So all the house of the mound. Now we don't know for sure where this was. The best guess, of course, is that it's someplace nearby Shechem. Maybe Shechem's fortress. Well, Shechem and all the Beth Millo, they take Abimelech and they make him king by the pillar of the terebinth, or the oak tree, that's there in Shechem. Now we could say, oh yeah, so Abimelech was made the king of Israel, so he was the first king, not Saul. Well, in a way, but at the same time, who gave them the right to choose a king for the nation? Remember, the Lord was the true king. So any other king chosen was a usurper. There's already one on the throne, Jehovah himself. So for Abimelech to claim the throne for himself, well, he has no right to it. And what right does Shechem have to choose for their nation? I mean, was Shechem elected to be the representatives of the whole nation of Israel, of all the other tribes? No, Shechem had no such right to choose the king for all of Israel. And so Abimelech, I don't believe, was ever really the king of the whole nation. And from his actions, we can see that he was more of a robber chieftain than a legitimate king. And I believe that Tola, the sixth judge, actually started his judgeship at the same time that Abimelech was supposedly quote-unquote king. So he was really just the usurper, and he never really had control over the whole nation. Verse 7. Now when they told Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim, and lifted his voice and cried out, and he said to them, "Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you." So Jotham hears a report. Remember, he was hiding so he wouldn't die. And he hears a report of the fact that they've made Abimelech king after his bloody deed of murdering all his half-siblings. So he goes and he stands on Gerizim. Gerizim was a mountain or high hill. Its name means cutting off. And apparently there was this mountaintop cut off from another one by a deep canyon. So that you could stand on one mountaintop and stand on the other and be very close to each other, hear each other, talk and converse, and yet couldn't get at each other. And these two mountains, Mount Gerizim, we recognize from in the book of Joshua, when half the tribes of Israel were supposed to stand on Mount Gerizim and give blessings for serving and obeying the Lord, and half of them stood on Mount Ebal and gave curses for disobeying the Lord. Well, Gerizim was the blessings mountain that they stood on. And apparently Abimelech and his usurpers are on Mount Ebal, where they can hear Jotham from Mount Gerizim, but they can't get at him. And so he has a message for them. He calls out to the men of Shechem, especially, although I think Abimelech was there too to hear. Verse 8, "The trees once went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.'" So he tells a story about trees. And he says that the trees went out to anoint a king over them. They wanted a king. So the first one they go to is the olive tree. And they ask the olive tree to reign over them. Well, what does the olive say? Verse 9. "But the olive tree said to them, 'Should I cease giving my oil, with which they honor God and men, and go to sway over trees?'" So the olive tree says that it's too busy producing oil to be king over all the other trees. It's too busy doing good, doing its job, to be king. Verse 10, "Then the tree said to the fig tree, 'You come and reign over us.'" So the trees go to the fig tree as their next choice, looking for the king of trees. And they say, "Hey, fig, you be the king." Verse 11, "But the fig tree said to them, 'Should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit and go to sway over trees?'" So the fig tree says, "I produce this sweet and good fruit, these figs. And should I leave my producing of figs to become king? No, no, I'm too busy producing good and sweet figs to become king." Verse 12, "Then the tree said to the vine, 'You come and reign over us.'" So they go to the vine. Now a vine isn't much of a tree. I mean, it climbs up the side of a tree. It's not much of a tree. So you can see that they are kind of reducing. The oil was kind of the king of trees, they thought. The fig was maybe good fruit producing. Now they're going to the vine. Well, it produces good fruit, although it isn't much of a tree. But what does the vine say? Verse 13, but the vine said to them, should I cease my new wine, which cheers both God and men, and go to sway over trees? So the vine says, I'm too busy producing grapes to make wine, to be king over the trees. So even the vine refuses them. Verse 14, then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. So now they're scraping the bottom of the barrel. They go to the bramble bush. And so they ask the bramble bush to be their king. Verse 15, and the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. So the bramble, this worthless bush, is ready to be king when the trees ask him. He doesn't have anything good to do. He's just a worthless bramble bush, so he might as well be king. But he calls on these mighty cedars to rest in his shadow. Now imagine this. Try to imagine this mighty cedar tree resting in the shadow of a little bramble bush. Well, it's ridiculous. But he says, well, if you won't obey me, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. He says, I'll destroy you if you don't obey me. Well, some king. Well, now we examine this, and some people will call this the parable of the trees. But I don't believe this is a parable at all. See, part of parable, the Greek is parabole, and bole means to cast, and para, you probably recognize that, that's like in parallel lines. You know, parallel lines are right next to each other, right? And parabole means to cast beside. And a parable is a story that's cast beside the truth. It matches with the truth in all important points. And that's not what's going on here. Does this story match what happened? No, what happened is that Abimelech came to the men of Shechem and proposed being king. The men of Shechem didn't go out and ask one guy and he refused, and ask another guy and he refused, and ask another guy and he refused, and then go to Abimelech. No, that's not what happened at all. So this is not a parable. And we need to understand that though people have this idea that everything in the Bible either has to be a parable or else be literal truth, that the Bible uses more forms than just parable and literal narrative. And what I believe we have here is a fable. Do you know what a fable is? Most people, when they've heard of fables, they think of Aesop's fables. Well, a fable is a story. And often in that story, things like animals, or in this case, trees, will talk and act like men, will act like human beings. But these stories are clever stories that are meant to illustrate a point. But they aren't parables. They aren't parallel with their point. They're illustrative. And I believe that's clearly what this is. It's a fable, trees walking and talking and looking for kings. But this is also a satirical fable. It's a satire. And understand that a satire, again, well, it makes fun of, it satirizes things that are going on. It's not a parallel. It's not a parable. It doesn't say exactly what it's satirizing. Now, satires are difficult forms of literature because typically you satirize conditions and events of the day. And so as soon as those conditions end and those current events are gone, satires become almost ununderstandable. You can't understand them. You can't get them. A big example of a satire is Gulliver's Travels. Gulliver's Travels is still read today, long after the things it was making a satire of are gone. And as you read Gulliver's Travels, maybe you can kind of tell he's making fun of something, but you can't really tell what, because you don't live in his day. And the things he was making fun of are long since gone. It's said that the man who wrote The Three Musketeers wrote it off of a book he found in a library that he thought was a swashbuckling adventure. But really, historians now think that it was a satire of conditions of the day. But Alexandre Dumas didn't understand it because he was reading it 200 years later when those conditions were gone. Now, there's another satire in the Bible in the Old Testament in 2 Samuel 12 and verse 1. The story that Nathan tells to David after David's sin. He says to him, there were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man, who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb, because he did this thing and because he had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man." Now Nathan here, and of course the Lord through Nathan, satirized what David had done. This isn't a fable, but it is a satire. And we can see that it's not a parable. Why not? Well, if it was a parable, we would expect that the rich man would have killed the poor man and taken his lamb to add to his own flocks. That's what David had done. He had killed Uriah and added his wife Bathsheba to his own harem of wives. But this is not a parable, it's a satire. It's clearly referring to what David had done, but it's not an exact parallel of what David had done. It's a satire. And the same thing is true of Jotham's satirical fable. So understand, this is not a parable, in spite of the fact that it's labeled that in many study Bibles of the day. This is a satire, and he had satirized Abimelech's actions and the actions of the men of Shechem. So after he gives his satirical fable, he says what he literally means in verse 16. "Now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done to him as he deserves..." Well, obviously this is not what Jotham thinks. They haven't acted truly and sincerely in making Abimelech king. And they certainly haven't treated Gideon's family the way they deserve. And he points this out in verse 17. "For my father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian." Remember, Midian wanted to wipe Israel out. They were destroying all their crops and wanted to see them slowly starve to death. This wasn't just oppression. This was trying to wipe them from existence. And Gideon had risked his life to save them from that. Verse 18, "But you have risen up against my father's house this day and killed his 70 sons on one stone and made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the men of Shechem, because he is your brother." So he points out bluntly what they did. In spite of all Gideon did to save them from certain death, they murdered his 70 sons on one stone and made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, his slave, king, just because he was related to them. Well, he says, verse 19, "If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you." Now, I think there's no doubt that Jotham is being sarcastic here. Obviously, they haven't acted in truth and sincerity, so he doesn't want them to rejoice in each other. Verse 20, "But if not, let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Millo. And let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech." So this was his point, and the point of his satirical fable, is that his curse on them is that fire will come from Abimelech and devour Shechem and Beth Millo, and fire will come from Shechem and Beth Millo and devour Abimelech. He says, "May you traitors, may you treacherous men, may you destroy each other." And we'll see as we go through the chapter, that's exactly what happened. And Jotham's curse becomes God's curse on these wicked men. 21, "And Jotham ran away and fled and went to Beer and dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother." So Jotham was protected because he was on Mount Gerizim, cut off from where they were. So he could talk to them, but they couldn't get to him. But after talking, he knew they could get around eventually. So he ran away and fled. And he went to Beer, which means a well. And as far as we can tell, it was on the border of Israel and Moab. So he went to a remote place where he's hoping they can't find him, and he dwells there because he's afraid of Abimelech, his brother. Of course, having killed all his other brothers, he would happily kill Jotham too. But Jotham was right. What they had done was treacherous and wicked. And we'll see that his curse will come true on these wicked Shechemites and Abimelech. But these Israelites of Shechem showed no gratitude to the family of Gideon, even after he rescued them from certain destruction at the hands of Midian. This is a common feeling of human beings. What have you done for me lately? And sadly, people will show the same ingratitude toward God as they show toward his representatives like Gideon. Are we thankful to the Lord for the glorious salvation he has provided for us? Or do we just say, yeah, that's good, but what have you done for me lately? Well, let's not be like Abimelech and the men of Shechem. Let's always remember what the Lord did for us and be grateful.
The treachery against the family of Gideon is sarcastically exposed with the satirical story of Jotham's trees. Like Israel, we too often forget all that God has done for us through Christ. He has saved us, he has kept us, and he has promised us a glorious future. May we always be grateful for all that God has done for us. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the usurper Abimelech. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Judges with Abimelech versus Gaal. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that as you listen to this program, you are becoming more and more motivated to study God's Word. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.